On the evening of March 11, 2020, at the Bozeman Public Library, a panel discussion titled "The Facts About Coronavirus, COVID-19 was moderated by Matt Kelly, Health Officer of the Gallatin City County Health Department, including Cindy Spinelli, Communicable Disease Program Manager, Gallatin City County Health Department, Patrick Lonergan, Chief of Emergency Management and Fire, Gallatin County, Michael Blake, MD, PhD Pediatrician, Bozeman Health, Mike Multiverney, Deputy Chief Operations, Bozeman Fire Department, and Emma Kate Loveday, PhD, Postdoctoral Researcher, Montana State University, Bozeman. They were introduced by Bozeman Public Librarian Beth Boyson.
Welcome to Bozeman Public Library. I was just wondering, is anyone here for the very first time? Oh, that's kind of good. I also wanted to let everyone know that this event is being recorded on KGVM for later broadcast. And we'll also put it on the library's website. So if someone you know didn't attend because they had an event or they're worried about coming out, you can let them know about that. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to introduce our moderator, Matt Kelly. He is from the Gallatin City County Health Department. Thank you, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you. So my name is Matt Kelly. I'm the health officer with Gallatin City County Health Department. That just means I'm the director of the department. I've been in the job for 10 years this month. I can tell you this is the most intense period of time that we have had at the health department in that 10 years, in that decade. A couple weeks ago, we really started to try to shift this conversation. The conversation has really focused for a great deal of time on the barricade mentality. We talk a lot about quarantine. We talk a lot about closing borders. We talk a lot about face masks and those things that make us feel safe because they're the barricade, keeping it out. And those are surely important public health measures that we have used and will continue to use. But I think it's also important that we include in that conversations about things that we can all do to protect ourselves, to protect our community, and to come to an understanding that we are likely going to be living with this virus. Maybe not personally inside of our bodies, but certainly in our community. And it's certainly likely that we'll have neighbors and we'll have people that we know, perhaps people we love, who are diagnosed with the virus. And I think that's not something to be terrified about. Most people who contract the virus recover fully and only have mild symptoms. But there are some things that we can do, and we've assembled, I think the library has done a nice job assembling a group tonight that can talk about some of these things. But as soon as we start trying to have that conversation, current events catch up with us. Just today, we had the WHO, the World Health Organization, declare the situation a pandemic. We had Montana State cancel the National Conference for Undergraduate Research that they had scheduled for the week after next. And we had the first Montana, we learned today that the first Montanan was diagnosed with COVID-19. That person is not in Montana and hasn't been in Montana for quite some time. So there's no exposures that we're aware of in the state, but it still is something that's closer to home. So even as we try to shift that conversation, the hustle bustle of the news cycle catches up with us and we get pulled back into discussing things like pandemic and epidemic and those sorts of things. But we've got a panel here that we hope can kind of talk about this in a lot of different ways and have this conversation in a comprehensive way and not focus on any one particular aspect of it. Cindy Spinelli is closest to me here. She's the Communicable Disease Program Manager at Gallatin City County Health Department. Cindy was a Peace Corps volunteer in Nepal where she worked on health services. And she's worked as a nurse in Washington, D.C. and Bozeman and was adjunct faculty at MSU when we stole her away, and we're really glad we did. She joined the health department in 2013 and has since become program manager of our communicable disease program. She's also helping to lead the response to COVID-19 and working directly with healthcare providers, first responders, and community partners. Patrick Lonergan is the chief of emergency management and fire for Gallatin County. He's worked in emergency services since 1995 with a background in emergency management, wildland firefighting, emergency medical services, search and rescue, ski patrol, law enforcement, technical rescue, hazardous materials, and incident management teams. That's a lot. He's also kind of the glue that holds us together. There's incident management teams happening at the health department, at Bozeman Health, at Montana State, community health partners, and Patrick is an incredible resource to us to help us pull that response together and to keep us connected. With the restructuring, he now works for the county in that role as chief of emergency management. Dr. Michael Blake is in practice in Bozeman Health with Bozeman Health Pediatric Group. He's a graduate of the University of North Dakota School of Medicine and completed his residency in pediatrics and a fellowship in pediatric clinical pharmacology at Children's Mercy Hospitals in Kansas City. Dr. Blake previously earned a PhD in neuropharmacology from Marquette University in Milwaukee, my hometown, before entering medical school. He was a pediatrician. He was a pediatrician, clinical pharmacologist in Kansas City, and a general pediatrician in Iowa before he joined the medical staff at Bozeman Health in 2009. He's board certified in pediatrics. Mike Multiverni has succeeded in keeping a low profile on the web, so I was able to pull from the website that he was fire chief in Rapid City, South Dakota. He's been in that game for 30 years and came to us just a few years ago and is deputy chief of operations for Bozeman Fire Department. He's going to talk to us about 911 response and how we prepare for that. And Emma Kate Loveday, who I have not yet met, is a postdoctoral researcher at the Chang Soft Matter and Microfluidics Lab, that's hard to say, at Montana State. She's dedicated much of her career to understanding the cellular and molecular mechanisms of microbial infections and working to understand the contributions from both the pathogen and the host in an attempt to develop new methods for disease prevention and treatment. Her current research is focused on understanding influenza A infectivity, replication and transcription, and host cell responses at the single cell level. We're going to start tonight. Cindy's going to give us kind of an overview of COVID-19. We want to get to a point where we were able to take questions. I think we start at the beginning and have a conversation about what this is that we're dealing with, kind of at a higher level. Cindy?
All right, so up here on the right is our virus that we're talking about. It's a new virus to us, but the family of coronaviruses is not new. We know that there's four that circulate most of the year. They're responsible, actually, for a large chunk of our community-acquired pneumonia cases. And then we have two other coronaviruses, the MERS and the SARS. The MERS was the one that was from camels, and then SARS was the severe acute respiratory syndrome. This one is spread by droplets, as the other coronaviruses are. I need to have a cough. I need to cough all over you, and then you take in those droplets. So it's really close contact. And the thing with these droplets is they don't really go further than 6 feet. So we're lucky. It's not like measles where it can stay in the air forever. That's going to be a 6 feet, and they just kind of dissipate. So it's really close contact with people, and it's mostly your friends and family that are going to give it to you. And you don't perceive those people as dangerous, so you're not taking the proper precautions around them. We also think that there's some surfaces that get infected. Luckily, it's not a really strong virus, so it can be cleaned with proper cleaning materials. There's a small study that came out of Singapore where they have a lot of corona cases. They swabbed the surfaces, found the virus, cleaned it just normally, swabbed the surfaces again, and didn't find the virus. So that's really promising, because as long as we're cleaning, washing our hands, staying away within that 6-foot bubble from people, we have a lot of protection. So it's about 2 to 14 days incubation period. So that's the time from when you're infected with it to when you start having symptoms. And really, most people are going to have symptoms around 5 to 7 days. And it looks like almost everyone is by day 12, and then 2 days have been added on for a little bit extra protection. Most of the cases are mild. These numbers are hard to estimate, though, because we truly don't know how many cases we have out there. Every country has different criteria for how they're testing people. So our criteria before was you had to be sick enough to be hospitalized pretty much to get tested. So how many other cases are walking around of someone who's not that sick? So that's the estimate is 80%, and that'll probably change. Most people have pretty mild symptoms, fever and dry cough, and it's flu season, common cold season. Who hasn't had a fever and a dry cough lately? So it's also something that doesn't make you really worried that you might be infected with something. So what are some of the things you can do? There's actually quite a lot you can do. You can avoid people who are sick and coughing on you, and you don't need to run out of the room. That 6-foot bubble is really enough to protect you. I want you to wash your hands long enough to get everything off, especially after you cough, sneeze, use the bathroom before you eat. If you were in some high-use area, go ahead and wash your hands. I have a really interesting study where they swabbed the surfaces in the airports to see where they found viruses. So it was like regular coronaviruses, flu, and they found the most on those bins that you put your shoes and your clothes on and go through. And then just think about all the things you touch. Wash your hands after that. I know everyone's making fun of the don't touch your nose and your face and your eyes, and that has a caveat to it unless you've just washed your hands. So if you have clean hands, do whatever you need to do up there, but don't do it with dirty hands. So don't go through security and then start playing around with your face. Go wash your hands and do what you need to do. The other thing is stay home if you're sick. Not a lot of people do that. We're looking at some community interventions that might make it easier for people. So encouraging businesses to get rid of the requirement that you need a doctor's note, because we don't want sick people in the doctor's office. And making it easier for people to stay at home. We do have some people who are in quarantine right now who've come back from Italy, and some of their jobs are giving them short-term disability. So there's, some options there for folks. Cover your coughs and sneezes. Be considerate of people around you. So just cover with your elbow or into your elbow. And then keep cleaning your house. Disinfect areas frequently. This, like I said, you don't need to use anything fancy. You can just wash your sheets and hand towels in regular hot water and dryer. To mask or not to mask? Everyone wants to know the answer to this. So there are two different masks there. The lovely mannequin on the left has the surgical mask on. And this is what you see most people having on. So this mask is really good if you have the cough or the sneezes and you're trying to protect other people from you. This mask does not do much to protect you from other people. The mask on the right is the N95 mask. That one is the one that healthcare workers are using, and it's really important that we have enough of those for healthcare workers and first responders, because if they need to do an intervention that's going to cause aerosolization, so that's giving someone a nebulizer, collecting a sample from the back of their throat or their nose, the healthcare worker needs to wear that mask to make sure that they don't get sick. The healthcare worker is also fitted for that mask. So they come in different sizes, different brands. You have to put a hood on your head. You put that mask on, you get sprayed this like saccharin sort of thing, and you need to make sure that you can't taste that in your mouth to ensure that there's a real seal. So just buying that from Ace Hardware isn't doing anything for you if you haven't been fit tested. So if you were the person who bought all of the face masks from Ace Hardware, can you please bring them to the hospital? So what we're encouraging is in healthcare facilities, when people come in and they have a cough, go ahead and put the face mask on, the surgical mask, and that's going to protect the people around you. Your healthcare worker, there's a huge shortage of these N95 masks, so they are protected if you have this face mask on and they have that face mask on. And that's going to go for our first responders if they're going to get someone who's sick or needing to transport people. All right, the other question we get a lot is travelers, and this is changing all of the time. In the beginning, we were getting notified of people coming from China, and we were monitoring them. That's loosened up now because there's more countries and there's more cases in the U.S., so it's like, how do you appropriately use small health departments' time tracking people? So now as people are coming through, they're getting this note, and this is from the countries, the level 3 countries, that tell them what to do. There was a study that looked at all of the temperature scanning, and they haven't really found that that's been effective in identifying cases, but they have found cases of COVID because someone said, I got this card, and it said to call when I had a cough. Those people got tested, and they actually found them. Testing is key because in all the studies we see, if someone knows they have COVID, they're better at keeping social distancing. People in the house are able to wash their hands more. So we had a study with 10 cases. This was in the MMWR last week. And from 455 contacts, they had 45 people or so who were sick enough to be tested, and only two of those people became positive. So that's the value of testing, because you really know who has it and you can take those precautions. Who's most at risk? If 80% of people have mild symptoms, what's the big deal? Well, it's a really big deal for the other 20% who are in this high-risk category. And so these are the people that, when I look around the community, I'm worried about. So our older adults, people who have serious chronic medical conditions like heart disease, diabetes, lung disease. So at the health department, we were able to bring in somebody to go to our senior centers and do assessments there to see what they need and just give them a helping hand for their planning. So we saw in Seattle, the majority of their deaths came from the senior center, the nursing home there. So if you're in one of these high-risk categories, what can you do? Take care of yourself. So get your flu shot, try and stay healthy, exercising, being outside, having a good support group, trying not to go to things at the library about COVID. The other thing is, make a plan. Do you have someone who's checking in on you? Do you know that you have a neighbor that maybe people don't come by? Do you need to check on them? Do you have enough medication that if you get diagnosed and you can't leave, you're able to take the meds that you normally do for high blood pressure and that sort of thing? Do you have enough supplies at home if there's something else that you need supplies for that's really important? If there's local transmission, and we don't have that yet, but if we start to have local transmission, then start reducing your exposure to other people. So that might mean going to the grocery store when it's a little bit quieter, going out for walks where it's less crowded, that sort of thing, so that you're exposed to fewer people. And then call your healthcare provider quickly if you get sick, because then we can get you tested and know what we're working with. And when I think about this, you think about outbreaks we've had before and different viruses that have come, and you look back at it retrospectively, and who do you want to be? Do you want to be the person that helped out their neighbor, or do you want to be the person who called the school and yelled at them for 2 hours because you don't like their decision? Or did you want to be the person that went and picked up prescriptions for someone? What questions are there?
Cough droplet size.
Okay, what droplet size do we worry about? Have you ever been somewhere and seen someone cough or sneeze and the light's just right and you see those little droplets? That's exactly the size. Those masks, the N95 masks, seem to be, as long as the healthcare worker is wearing it, to be protective. And then they also, some facilities are using things called PAPRs, and that's kind of the, have you seen them? They look like a hood. And those are also protective. They're pretty large droplets. Can the droplets get into your eyes? Yes, there is a risk categorization for healthcare workers that are doing aerosolizing producing procedures. And so depending on what you're doing, you would wear different protection. And all of that changes if the patient you're working with has that surgical mask on, because those droplets aren't going out everywhere. Exactly. Yeah. What is the point of containment, is the question.
Well, what is the point of containment if it's not going to be contained?
I guess the Chancellor of Germany said something, and that, I will say, is a challenge here. With the way that our social media works and the way that our media works, a lot of people say a lot of things. And it's very difficult to react and respond to all of those things. But it's true. We're likely to see how people contract this disease. What one benefit of having some of these barriers in place is to slow it down and buy us time. Some of the things that happened in China, some of the things that are happening in Italy right now, are buying us time. And that time is valuable. We have a staff person going into long-term care facilities to really talk to long-term care facilities where we see there's a lot of risk, to talk to long-term care facilities about what resources they have, what understanding they have, and what they need. Every day that we can slow this down is a day that we can buy ourselves to respond to it, understand it better, and deal with it better. So you're right. That's what I was trying to say at the beginning. I think the idea that we're just going to put up barriers and barricades to this and protect ourselves, that's going by the wayside, and we need to really think about how we're going to live with this as a community. Dr. Blake, do you have anything to add?
I'd seen this really from the news report, but if you have a large group of people that get infected very rapidly, think of it in terms of the healthcare system to be able to manage that, right? So then you'll overwhelm your healthcare facility. You'll have to have, you know, where you're going to put people. Whereas if you can slow that down, hopefully the healthcare capacity can keep up with the demand for the need for that.
Dr. Loveday, do you have anything to add to that?
I was actually going to say the exact same thing, that having a slowdown of spread by taking these precautionary measures is really going to be more supportive of our healthcare facilities more so than anything else. Because if we can provide people that need intensive care, that care without being overwhelmed, we can maybe turn the tide on some of these severe cases. But yes, I would absolutely agree with Dr. Blake.
Dr. Blake, one of the things when we deal with communicable disease outbreaks like pertussis and measles that we often worry about is our kids. Those of us who have kids and just society in general, that's often what where our first thoughts go. One of the only encouraging things that I have read about this virus in recent months is that children are doing pretty well with it. You want to talk about that and how you're dealing with it at the pediatric level right now?
And that's my understanding, too, is that the attack rate on really kids less than 19 has been very small. I don't think there's been any reported deaths of anybody less than the age of 9. And typically you think of like influenza, it's like kids less than 2 and the elderly, but the young kids are part of that, too. That's just data that I've heard and come across. So what's the reason for that? It's not really sure. Are they actually, can they be asymptomatic carriers? I don't think that that's been totally worked out. I did see a question posed on the internet somewhere about asking about, well, what about pregnant moms? Is there a risk for birth defects like we know is true for other viruses? This is new, but if it's like influenza is not necessarily known to do that. Pregnant moms are, their immune system is marginally compromised anyway, so certainly extra precaution for pregnant moms is a good idea. There's been no evidence that there's maternal to fetal spread of the virus like there is with some concerning viruses. And then in terms of what we see, we were talking briefly about the psychological component on kids because they hear so much on social media and it's very scary. And what should parents tell their kids? And I think the same thing you'd say about any infection, you know, make sure you're washing your hands and the things that we say just for everyone.
So the question is how Bozeman Health is responding to this. And we actually have the incident commander for Bozeman Health here.
Hi, I'm Callie Kajawa. I'm the director of quality and safety and have been the incident commander for our pandemic preparedness and response. What I think is important for all of you to understand is that we have an emergency operation plan that we have compiled and drafted based on FEMA's recommendations for how hospital incident commands should respond to emergencies. And those are emergencies of all types. So any sort of mass casualty incident or outbreak or anything like that, we would respond the same exact way, which we have. So we've stood up our incident command. We have a whole list of people who are on our task force and on our team to, as an infection prevention standpoint, monitoring our procedures for what we do when patients come in. We're developing surge plans, and we do have surge plans, but we're currently updating those as we see the landscape change across the nation. So those surge plans would include how do we accommodate a high volume of patients who are pretty well, but suspect that they may have the virus and need to be tested, as well as for patients who are very sick and need emergency services or hospitalization. We are also monitoring our supplies very closely to be sure that we have the appropriate protective equipment for our healthcare workers so that they can safely care for the patients who come our way. Yeah, so the question was, do we have any test kits at Bozeman Health? And we do not. I don't know if, Cindy, you want to take this question.
Right now, the testing is done at the Montana Public Health Lab in Helena, so we coordinate with the providers to collect the samples. And right now, since there's about 200 kits or so, we want to rule out other respiratory pathogens. So if that panel comes back negative, then we're sending testing on to Helena. And that turnaround time's been a lot faster than when we had to send it to CDC.
Yeah, so all of our testing, we're consulting with the health department, and they're helping us get all of the tests to the public health lab.
A report just came out today, actually, from Rocky Mountain Labs over in Hamilton, Montana, in which they tested a number of different surfaces specifically for the SARS-CoV-2 virus. It basically can last on a surface for up to 3 days if it's not cleaned before the virus basically falls apart. Something like cardboard boxes, it was 24 hours. So the virus itself can hang out for a little bit, not for too long. But as Cindy mentioned, basic hand sanitizing wipes, if you wanted to wipe your wallet down or your belt, wash your hands after touching those sorts of things at the airport, all of these things are going to stop transmission of that virus because soap and alcohol over 60% will inactivate it. So any of those hand sanitizers, any of those wipes, and really soap is really fantastic, easy way to take care of things. It does a fantastic job of punching holes in that lipid membrane around that virus. So
I think that's important because I think we've heard about the shortages of hand sanitizer. Dr. Lovejoy, can you talk about, I think to reiterate what you're saying, what we're telling people is even if you have hand sanitizer, getting to a place where you can wash your hands and get the debris off your hands. Hand sanitizer isn't effective if your hands are visibly dirty all the time. So the hand sanitizer is kind of a bridge to the point in time when you can get to a sink and hot water and soap. And in this climate, if your hands aren't dry, if you don't have to use lotion, you're probably not washing your hands enough. I mean, my hands are raw because I'm washing my hands to that extent. So my wife tells me I should be using more lotion. But Patrick, can you talk about what is incident command? And part of what you're doing is pulling the various incident commands that are around. So the health department has an incident command. Our incident commander is in the back of the room, is Tracy Kniedler. Bozeman Health has an incident command. You just heard from her. Community Health Partners has an incident command. The state has an incident command. Can you talk about how that functions and what that means and why it's important?
So the incident command system as we know it today started in California in the 1960s and ultimately came out of a study of managing large incidents in a large battlefield model. I forget the exact term, out of the military. And basically it brings a standardized model for managing incidents with common terminology and a common chain of command that allows for expansion and contraction of an incident as the incident changes over time. So by using the incident command system, it identifies, based on these common terms and roles, what people do. It eliminates duplication to clear who's responsible for what. It also provides modularity, so you can bring in somebody to help fill in or support an organization that maybe needs more depth in a given area, or somebody needs some time off, and you bring in somebody that has that skill set and they know what their job is because it's the same no matter what incident, whether that's their public information officer, or maybe they do logistics support and help support the incident. It's the same function. And that's really the core of the incident command system. It provides a common structure, a unity of command, and provides scalability. And so as the incident gets larger, you can add to it and maintain that structure. And as the incidents ramp down, you can scale back and still maintain a common structure for management of that operation.
So what that means in our response, there's common terminology and common positions in incident command. For instance, right now, I'm not serving as the incident commander at the health department. I'm serving as the public information officer and kind of a mix of the liaison officer role. I know that at Bozeman Health, I know who my counterpart is there, and I can call her and I can talk to her about their communications. Likewise, our incident commanders know who each other are. We know what their roles are. They can communicate about the operational things like how we testing, who we're testing, surge planning, and those sorts of things. And that's really important because it creates a level of communication and consistency and transparency between the organizations. Mike, do you want to talk about first responders and what their concerns are right now and kind of how first responders are adapting to this situation?
Yeah, so I guess I can speak to I'd call it the pre-hospital care component of what we're dealing with tonight, and which really, if you think about that, that's when the 911 system gets activated. So if somebody is at home and they deem that they'd like to go see a physician at the emergency department, they would call 911 and the fire department and an ambulance would show up, and maybe even a police officer. So really that's what we're looking at, is that first responder role or that pre-hospital setting. And we've had really, really good flow of information from all of our partners that you see up here. They've been sharing all the latest information with us to make sure our first and foremost priority is that our responders are safe. We view our emergency response role as critical infrastructure. So if we run short on police officers and firefighters and EMTs and paramedics, we're going to be in a crisis in our community. So first and foremost, we look after our responder safety. And so things like the protective equipment that Cindy did a great job of explaining, we're equipped with the appropriate level of protection like has been outlined tonight. We've got a reserve supply of the masks that we talked about, lots and lots of surgical masks, and we've implemented some different procedures in our 911 center. So if someone does call in, if they answer certain questions that dispatcher asks that puts them into a high-risk category for this virus, then that notifies the responders that we're going to a scene where maybe we've got a potential patient. So we really don't alter our response too much, and that it's just good awareness, and again, it helps our responders stay safe, and we go into the home with the right level of equipment. Treatment is pretty much the same for us. All of our EMTs and paramedics that work for the fire department and the ambulance service are trained to deal with these types of, really we're talking about respiratory illness or flu-like symptoms, which we deal with literally year-round, so there's not a huge change for us. We've worked really close with the emergency department to assure that we have a really good handoff, so if we notify them in advance that we might be bringing in a patient that's at risk, we communicate with them in advance to our arrival at the hospital so we don't bring that person into a clean or sterile environment and potentially contaminate an area of the hospital. So it's really, to Patrick's point, it's about coordination and sharing of information. And so that starts from the 911 call all the way through to how the hospital deals or even the clinical setting. So I feel like we're pretty well prepared. It's something we deal with other times of the year. It just happens to be that this one's a little different.
You want to talk about your connection to the hospital and Dr. Lowe and the emergency room and kind of how that guidance comes down? I think it's an important thing to understand. Maybe people don't understand is that first responders aren't out there just doing their own thing, that they're connected to the healthcare providers of the hospital in a specific way.
Yep, that's a great question. So any agency in the county that has any type of a medical role in the community in that pre-hospital setting before that patient gets to the hospital, we're under very, very strict medical control. And we have a couple of physicians here in town that assume that role for all those agencies in the county, two local physicians that work in the emergency department. They help craft, they monitor, they police, if you will, our protocols. So we have very strict guidelines on how we treat patients in the field to make sure that they're getting the highest level of quality that we can provide. So they do everything from chart review. They give us clear direction. If there's emerging trends in our industries, those are shared down through those two physicians. And so if we've had questions in the last couple of weeks about our response and our role and to make sure that we have the most accurate information in that pre-hospital setting, we look to our medical directors and they take very good care of us. And having them as emergency room physicians, they are very familiar with what our role is in the community and taking care of patients. So,
and likewise, that you know, those doctors Lowe and Beer are talking to us on a fairly regular basis, and I get calls from them every once in a while. I think that's important to understand that we're not doing this work in isolation. The question has to do with all the things that we do every day, and we touch things all day long that other people have been touching, particularly credit card machines, gas station pumps, door handles, those sorts of things. My answer to that is that's why washing your hands is so important, and that's why trying not to touch your face. You can't remove all risk in the world, but you can wash your hands, and you can avoid touching your face, touching your food before you wash your hands. But I think we have some people who have more expertise than me who might have something to add to that. Dr. Lovejoy, anything there?
No, I think that kind of sums it up. The virus itself has a lipid envelope around it, so it's made of fats. The way soap is structured is it puts holes in things like lipids, which is why it's so effective at breaking down those virus particles. So when you do wash your hands with soap, I think the rule is to sing the happy birthday song twice. There's a lot of different ways to do that circulating online. I think repeating the beginning of Star Trek has proven to be long enough. So find a creative way to wash your hands for long enough. But I mean, really, that is the number one thing that you can do when you are touching all these sorts of things. I have a 5-year-old at home, and good Lord, you want to talk about germs coming back with you. So I understand your concern, and really, we cannot stress that enough.
Comment on the fomites and picking up personal items too, from a kind of a kid's perspective too. We were talking about it, and he said, "Well, I cleaned it off this morning." Remember, kids think concretely. It's like, well, I cleaned it this morning, so therefore it must be sterile forever. But no, if you come in contact with other things that could potentially transmit the virus, you need to wipe it down again.
I'm just going to walk everybody through some of the basic virology concerning this particular virus so you have a little bit more information, especially when you start hearing about things in the news and maybe hear some information in the news and know whether it's accurate or not. One of the first things is, what exactly is a coronavirus? This is an electron micrograph of the virus itself. There's lots of different types of coronaviruses, but it belongs to this family called the Coronaviridae family, and corona basically stands for crown, which is from these green spikes that protrude around. When the scientists first saw this in the early 1940s, 1950s, they thought it looked like a crown around the virus, which is where it gets its name. It's a positive sense single-stranded RNA virus, which might not make a lot of sense to a lot of people, but just know that this is a virus that has a very large genome, and we understand its structure. It is enveloped, as I mentioned. It has that lipid envelope around it that makes it susceptible to things like soap very easily. And it's about 100 to 160 nanometers in diameter. So there are regular human coronaviruses that cause about 30% of all colds on a seasonal basis. Two of these are called alpha coronaviruses, and two of these are called beta coronaviruses. And then we have two, now three, zoonotic coronaviruses. These are coronaviruses that have been transmitted from animals to people. So they don't circulate directly in people normally. And that is the MERS virus, which, as Cindy said, we acquire from camels, that arose in 2012 till now. And then the very first SARS virus back in 2002 to 2004. So this virus looks like this if we want to blow it up in terms of looking at the kind of molecular structures of it. It has this spike glycoprotein that goes around the outside, has this nucleoprotein that covers its genome to protect it, has this small envelope protein and a membrane protein. And most of the immunity that is developed is to this spike protein. This is kind of our number one target when we're talking about any sort of vaccine development, any sort of small molecule like drug treatments. We are targeting this spike protein because this spike protein is what gets the virus into your cells. So this spike protein uses the human ACE2 protein, which is on the outside of cells, as a receptor. So it's basically like a little lock and key mechanism, where the lock is the ACE2 receptor, and the key is that spike protein. So it fits in nicely, and this mediates basically the cell engulfing the virus. So it kind of almost, in a sense, wants to eat it. The ACE2 receptor is used by the previous SARS coronavirus and also by this one. And we have lots of information about this receptor because we've had a lot of research on it from the previous SARS outbreak. So this is like a molecular structure of the actual SARS coronavirus spike protein. And the green, basically what looks like a glob there, is the receptor bound to this spike protein. So we really have a lot of information about one of these major receptors since we've done a lot of work on coronaviruses since 2002. So how did this actually get named? So this here is what we call a tree, and it shows the relationship of different viruses. So the closer they are together in the tree means they're more closely related, kind of like a family tree. And the disease itself is called coronavirus disease 2019, or COVID-19. So when we're talking about the disease in people, this is what you're going to hear referred to, whereas the virus itself has been named SARS coronavirus 2. So you might hear these names used interchangeably, but they do mean two kind of different things. One is describing the virus, one is describing the actual disease. Our human seasonal coronaviruses, they're pretty well separated from our little family tree here, from the SARS virus and the SARS coronavirus 2, which are in red at the top. And here's our new one. So there's about 80% similarity between the original SARS virus and this one. So they're not exactly the same. And those changes are probably why we see so much more infection rates with this new one than we did back in 2002. So where did it come from? Again, this is another very busy tree that shows relationships of lots of different coronaviruses that have been sequenced. But it does point out some really important information that I'm going to walk you through really quickly, in that the SARS coronavirus 2 is most closely aligned with other bat coronaviruses. So bats are the main reservoir of where these coronaviruses come from. And here's our new one. And all these blue sequences here are pretty much different coronaviruses that have been isolated from different bats. So we know that this virus most likely came from a bat. It may have most likely passed through some other animal, as did the original SARS virus back in 2002, which passed through another mammal called a palm civet. And that virus is right there in green. So it went from a bat to a palm civet to people. And we can see that relationship when we start looking at the genome. Right now, we know that this is most likely from a bat based on our sequence analysis. There were some reports that it might have come from a snake in the news. There's reports it maybe was generated in a lab. And none of these are accurate at all. We know from sequence analysis that any of those viruses that were working in the lab are too divergent. They're too different from this one to have come from those lab strains. We do not know right now where this virus went between humans and bats. Did it go directly from bats to people, or was there another intermediate or couple intermediate steps? We're not sure. There are a lot of fabulously smart scientists working on this, and it may take quite a bit of time to figure it out. It did for the original SARS virus, and it probably will in this case. The other important thing to know is how infectious is this virus. So we're thinking about this in terms of relationships to other viruses that we do know. So we hear a lot of talk about this R0, or this reproductive number. And this really describes how many people are going to get sick from a single person that has this virus. So one sick person represented in yellow is going to get how many other people sick. So for SARS, it's about 3.5 people get sick. For measles, one of our most infectious viruses that people face, the R0 value is actually around 18. So put that into perspective. For influenza, seasonal influenza, it's around 2 to 2.5. And you need an R0 value above 1 for continued transmission within a community. So the SARS coronavirus originally in 2002, 2003 had an R0 value of around 2.3 to 2.5. It was able to be stamped out because the majority of cases were not infectious until they were symptomatic. That doesn't seem to be the case with this one, which is may have helped spread. And our R0 value for coronavirus 19 is estimated to be around 2 or 3, but this is a constantly evolving number depending on how many people actually are tested and we know how many get sick. The attack rate, or what proportion of the population will get infected, assumptions on this are all over the place. 30 to 40% based on some of the estimates from some very well-known virologists that I know. I think Angela Merkel said around 70%. We really don't know because we don't know how many underlying cases there are. So symptoms, as Cindy went through, fever, cough, shortness of breath, and 80% mild cases, 15% severe. But one thing that I want to bring your attention to, as we've talked about, is how, why does soap help get rid of SARS? So this is the active ingredient, in the main detergent in hand soap is this sodium lauryl sulfate. And it's another ingredient is sodium olefin sulfonate. It works the same way, but it has this long lipid tail, this long kind of zigzag line at the end. And this basically punches holes right into lipids. And that is what surrounds this virus. And it will just punch holes right in that lipid membrane of the virus and inactivate it. So if the virus has fallen apart, it cannot seek its receptor and therefore pass infection. So this is really the main, probably the number one way to help protect yourself and help protect others in the community. So hopefully that helps to answer some of the main just molecular virology-based questions around this virus. And if anybody has any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them. So the question is, why not wear some nitrile gloves in your day-to-day business? I think it comes down to the same reason we don't want people buying all the masks at the hardware store is that the first responders, I mean, the people in the hospitals, we already have potential shortages coming down the line, even at the university level, that we're trying to make sure we have supply lines in place at MSU that remain constant and things like that. I think even for the hospital, for the health departments, for our first responders are much more important, whereas as we've probably harked on a bit too much, or maybe not enough, I'm not sure, that if we just go home and wash our hands, or if we do have some hand sanitizer, it's effective. It is 100% effective, so it works.
Let's keep in mind that The human body is beautifully engineered to fight these things off when they come into our body if we take care of it. So if we can feed ourselves nutritious foods, if we can keep ourselves hydrated, if we can get enough sleep, if we can avoid stay home when we're sick, our bodies can fight these things off. And we're seeing that with 80% of cases are mild cases. So I would say, like, we can talk about the barriers, and we should. We can talk about those barricades like gloves and masks. But we should also keep in mind that we have mechanisms inside of our body to fight these things off.
If you're wearing your gloves and then you mess with your face, you're just spreading it that way.
Montana State just went through a pretty difficult process where they had 4,000 undergraduates coming into an undergraduate research conference in about a week and a half. And they made the decision that they announced today to call that conference off. And that's a big deal for them. It's a big deal for the community. And I think we talked to them about it. And what we need people to do is think about the utility of the event. We need people to take responsibility for themselves. And if they think that they have a condition, or if they're of an age where they might be more susceptible, to stay away from those things. But I want to point out that the state of Montana had 12 million tourist visits last year, and about 40% of them, from what I read, came through Bozeman. The airport hosts 600,000 people a year. And even if we wanted to shut it all down, we couldn't shut it all down. People are coming. That doesn't mean that we mindlessly have every event that is out there. But I think what we're available to do is help people, help event organizers think through what is the benefit of having that event, what are the ramifications of canceling that event, and we can also provide them guidance from the Centers for Disease Control about things they can do to lower the risk during the event. But it's difficult, and I will acknowledge that we are seeing things happening in the headlines, and we're seeing things happening other places. It is extremely challenging. People are saying, they're doing that, why aren't we doing that? And we acknowledge that. And we stand ready to have those conversations with people, but I'm not ready at this point in time to tell people to cancel their entire life and to stop living their lives. I think it's important that we continue to be human beings, and we continue to have a sense of community. I'll acknowledge that it's a balancing act, and there's no black and white solutions to that.
What is the arc of this virus over time?
Is there a utility to postponing, because maybe we'll get to a point where this isn't such a big problem? Is that a good summation of your question?
So this virus, there's a couple mathematical modeling papers that have tried to look at what might happen in the future. And there's a couple different scenarios. One is that this might become a seasonal coronavirus that circulates in people. Another alternative is that in a couple years, it'll completely disappear. Another one is that it will become biennial, so it might come back every couple years and not be completely seasonal. But we really don't know. We don't have any specific antivirals to use. Vaccine development is probably at least a couple years off. We don't have the tools that we need when we had the swine flu pandemic, which was just over 10 years ago, to be able to combat this in a way and have a vaccine ready. There's a lot of talk about when we get to summer and the hot weather and it's just going to poof, disappear. We don't know that. So we kind of have to just take it one step at a time. But it seems like the testing and containment strategies in other countries, such as in China and in South Korea, has started to what they call flatten the curve, where you peak and then you get to the top and you're starting to not see this exponential rise in cases. If that occurs also in Italy, where we've seen this major lockdown of basically the entire country, we at least have some hope that if we can do the right containment procedures, we can prevent this transmission from continuing in the rate that it has been and start to flatten that curve and maybe get to the other side of it where we go down. But there is a lot of people considering these questions very deeply, and we really just don't have a lot of information to be able to say one way or another.
I talked to a microbiologist at MSU today who said that, you know, he was concerned that we're in that escalation right now, and now might be a time to really think about canceling some of those events. That was his take on it. I think the other thing that we know that I'm starting to think about, we talk about the epidemiology of the virus. I'm really starting to think about this in terms of the epidemiology of the anxiety. And I think we're at a peak anxiety level right now. I hope we are. It's really causing a lot of anxiety. And so I'm hoping that as time goes on, we'll have less anxiety. And that's another thing to keep in mind is that right now we have, and I think that probably factored into Montana State's decision, because there's so much concern about this right now that managing that became a very difficult thing to contemplate, in addition to the concern about the virus itself. The second question is there a chance that this virus will adapt and become more virulent over time? Oh, and the more hopeful question is there a chance that we're going to develop immunity to this?
From what I know about the other coronaviruses, you can get some bit of immunity, but because there's four of them, you're not sure which one you're getting, and they're not sure how long the immunity lasts. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, from the research that I've seen is that you can develop short-term immunity to these seasonal coronaviruses, but it does not appear to be lifelong immunity, as you find with things like if you get a measles infection, you're protected for your entire life after that. The coronaviruses seem to not generate that strong of an immunity, which is also an issue for vaccine development, because you want a vaccine that's going to give you longer term immunity. It might be more like the flu vaccine that we need to constantly get every year. And then in terms of mutations, remember I said this virus has an RNA genome. So viruses with RNA genomes, when they replicate and copy themselves and copy their genomes, they do it in a way where they can't go back and proofread, sort of like you would do like in your Word documents, and they can't fix mistakes. Our cells with our DNA genomes, we can fix mistakes. So we acquire less mutations over time. These RNA viruses acquire them all the time. They're constantly evolving. But you generally see when you get a virus into a population, it acquires mutations that potentially make it less virulent, more so than more virulent. We don't know what's going to happen with this one, but viruses want to be transmitted to the next host. So if you kill all of your hosts, you don't get there. So there's something to be said that once these things become more seasonal, it might end up being just like our normal seasonal strains that we see every year and actually be a little bit less virulent. But that's definitely one thing that we are watching in terms of the mutations that are acquired and how they might affect transmission and virulence for these viruses.
So the question is, how are we working with school districts, everybody else? Yeah. We're running every day to have conversations with people, many, many conversations. I sat down today with the leadership with the Bozeman School District and the Belgrade School District to think through how we might respond if we do have a case in a school or a case connected to a school. We have regular elected official calls that Patrick is really helpful. And it's not just elected officials. It's also the fire chiefs out there. It's the city administrators to be able to share the information we know. We're taking calls on a regular basis. We'll be working with the county superintendent. It really takes a lot of people in the game and heads in the game. And I want to acknowledge that we live in a community that's pretty cohesive that way. I mean, tonight we've got the mayor and the fire chief sitting out in the audience. We've got Commissioner Pomeroy is here. We've got the hospital here. We've got the city manager here. We've got the county represented by Patrick and myself. We're getting good support from the county. It's really complex and it's really multifaceted, and we're just doing everything we can to communicate with as many people in as many ways as we can. And that takes time, but we're working on it. The question is, for a child care provider, for people who are working with young children or maybe have young children, we all know that they're snotty all the time. How do you distinguish between this illness and the many other illnesses that are out there?
I would say it's very difficult. In fact, it's even difficult for physicians. And in personal examples, like, well, we've had kids come in, well, the whole family has influenza, right? We test them, they all have, and there's a six-month-old, there's a four-year-old, there's a three-year-old. The six-month-old has a little bit of a fever, actually is feeding well, and you wouldn't even know he was sick. The three-year-old has a temperature of 103 and is running around the room. You wouldn't know he was sick other than the fever. And the four-year-old has runny nose, cough, congestion, and looks like death warmed over sitting on the table. So I think the best approach would be, like you're doing, is just always repeating hand washing and maybe just the assumption that anybody at any time could be sicker than you know.
So the question is, are the symptoms different than adults?
No, I mean, there's a constellation of symptoms with any of these infections that you just mentioned, RSV, influenza, that present runny nose, cough, sure, fever, sure, maybe not. And it's not my understanding that there's that much difference. I mean, if you just look at the examples of what the symptoms are in adults, they're similar.
I think the other thing to say is repeating that we don't yet have a confirmed case in Montana. I would be careful about placing too much value in that. I think from safety's sake, assume that we probably do have cases that are undetected. I don't know that. I can't prove that. But our testing levels are fairly low because of the supply of test kits that was pretty slow to come. And so we're looking for the virus. But I think it's a good thing for people to assume to not have that false sense of security just because we haven't had a case yet. Spring break's coming. How to make decisions about whether to travel or whether not to travel. First thing I would say is to think about your own health condition. Think about your own situation. My parents are in their 70s. I've talked to them about trying to lay low for a while. I didn't have to convince them not to get on an airplane for a while. That's not guidance from the CDC or anything, but it's common sense maybe for them. My mom has a lot of issues and her immune system is just cashed. She doesn't really have much of an immune system anymore. The president just issued a directive banning travel to Europe other than Great Britain for 30 days, I think.
I would also consider, depending on where you're going, the chance of possible quarantine. We don't know if that's going to happen, but I mean, if you had traveled to Italy a week and a half ago, you would be stuck there. So, I mean, you could be stuck in worse places, but that could also be a consideration. I mean, there's been a big discussion about taking cruises and how that might not be a good idea right now. I think you just have to, on a personal basis, decide for yourself whether where you're going. Like, I would probably not want to go to Seattle right now, personally, but my husband just flew back from Vancouver, BC, because he had to come home and he went through Seattle. So wash your hands, wipe your seats down in the plane, and just try and be as clean as possible. But there's only so much you can control. But if I was traveling somewhere out of the country, I would maybe be concerned about possible quarantine if something did go wrong.
It was less of a question and more of a great statement that we don't want to be paranoid and we don't want to be scared. We want to be smart. And I think you're right that we're seeing this virus and this disease affecting people at older ages to a greater extent. And so I think being smart is taking that into consideration. Yeah. We're going to wrap it up because we're being kicked out of the library and I think we want to be sensitive to the people's time here. So thank you for coming tonight and feel free to come up and ask another question.
You have just heard a panel discussion held at the Bozeman Public Library on the evening of March 11, 2020, moderated by Matt Kelly, Health Officer of the Gallatin City County Health Department, including Cindy Spinelli, Communicable Disease Program Manager, Gallatin City County Health Department, Patrick Lonergan, Chief of Emergency Management and Fire, Gallatin County, Michael Blake, MD, PhD, Pediatrician, Bozeman Health, Mike Maltaverni, Deputy Chief Operations, Bozeman Fire Department, and Emma Kate Loveday, PhD, Postdoctoral Researcher, Montana State University, Bozeman. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded by Kit Stevenson and edited and produced by Joy LaClaire for KGVM, Gallatin Valley Community Radio, 95.9 FM, KGVM, Bozeman.